Welcome back to the Action Factor podcast as we continue with the 10-part audio course Neuro-Linguistic Programming in Residential Youth Work. Now, if you've just found us, then it's easy to skip back to the beginning and enjoy what I call commutable chunks. That is episodes you can listen to on the bus and practice at work. So thank you so much for joining me this week. As we get deeper into the course, I hope that you understand that the tools that got me to walk barefoot across burning hot coals might be useful in some form in your residential youth work. You can probably hear that I'm grinning cynically, of course, because I'm absolutely convinced of it. I know because most of it has worked for me in many, many forms of youth work and in the development of the Solutions Toolkit, if you don't know already, is my online course for residential youth work teams. Before we push on, let me quickly remind you that there will be notes where appropriate around here somewhere. And if you are a residential youth work team or a manager, you might be curious about a universal framework for working with young people. The course adapts some of the most powerful change therapy techniques ever created. And there is a free version available at the Action Factory. Now, that course in itself is entirely different to this little series of sessions because we're midway through NLP in residential youth work, and you're most welcome to skip back if you've missed any of the sessions. Okay, on with the show. Today, we're going to be discussing limiting beliefs. We all have them. Challenging our own limiting beliefs can be, well, they can be challenging. The extra dimension as a residential youth worker is, so do our clients. The young people we work with also have a series of limiting beliefs. And as seen as they're limiting, then we can safely assume we'd all be better off without them. They are the lies we tell ourselves. I'm not good at maths. I'm unlucky. I'll never get that job or the girl or the boy. I'm not good enough. If we are to successfully limit the limiting beliefs in ourselves and others, then we need to first understand them and to have an idea where they come from. This seems like an odd concept, doesn't it? Because after all, they're our beliefs, aren't they? We learn them, so aren't they just true? Well, that's what a belief seems to be. It seems to be just true. But it's not true, is it? It's just a story we tell ourselves. So let's talk about two boys who had a very abusive father. Very similar upbringing, violence, crime, and generally negative early life. As they grew older, one became a respected member of the community. He had a few kids, got married, and was generally an all-round good egg. And for his brother, the opposite was true. He was in and out of prison, abusive to his children, drugs, alcohol. So they were both asked the same question. Why do you think your life turned out the way it did? And what do you think their answers were? Well, what's incredible is that they both gave the same answer. With a child like I had, with a father like I had, why wouldn't it turn out this way? Incredible. The difference in their later lives was huge, but the belief system, or shall we say the story they told themselves, was very, very different. Their beliefs about their upbringing changed everything. If we knew how they formed those beliefs and how we could change them along the way, we would be miracle workers. But we're not. Instead, we're simply part of the story, part of the belief system of the young people we work with. The research shows that beliefs, in general, are like the lenses through which we view the world. They're shaped by our experiences, our upbringing, our culture, the people we surround ourselves with. And as we grow, we internalize messages from our environment, which gradually form into our belief system. So, for example, consider a teenager who's repeatedly told, you know, they're not good at maths. So over time, they start to believe it, and this belief affects their performance in math-related subjects. And in this case, the belief originates from external influences, such as teachers or parents, and unknowingly contribute to the formation of this limiting belief. There are said to be different levels of belief. They're not just a kind of one-size-fits-all. They come in various shapes and sizes. You've got stuff like core beliefs. You know, these are the deepest, rootest beliefs that often stem from childhood experiences or major life events. you know, a teenager who grew up in an environment where they felt unloved might develop a core belief that they're unworthy of love or affection. That's a typical kind of, you know, meme that we tend to follow. Then there's intermediate beliefs. Those beliefs are slightly more specific and tend to be linked to certain areas or aspects of life. So, you know, teenagers facing rejection, you try and join a sports team. That's something I can relate to after believing I was a liability in any sports team. Always the last one to get picked at games. And I might form an intermediate belief that I'm not good at sports, which could impact my willingness to try new physical activities or join sports-related clubs. Instead, I discovered cycling later in life and found myself doing 1,000-kilometre rides across Europe. Do I still believe I'm not good at sport? I kind of do, yeah. It's strange. It's still an identity thing. Then there's those surface beliefs. You know, these are the beliefs that are most accessible and might surface in everyday situations. You know, I'm not good to showcase my artwork. And that kind of discourages you from sharing your work. And it's kind of related to kind of self-esteem. The classic artist who stays kind of hidden and compliments and says, oh, it's not that good really, you know, I was just fooling around. So research in psychology and cognitive science has shown that our beliefs, they play a pivotal role in shaping our thoughts, our feelings and behaviours. So they act like filters influencing how we interpret the world around us. So studies have demonstrated that individuals with positive and empowering beliefs tend to have higher self-esteem, resilience, overall life satisfaction. And these are attributes we want for ourselves and we want for our young people. In contrast, limiting beliefs can act like kind of self-fulfilling prophecies. You know, someone believes they can't achieve something, they're less likely to even attempt it. And thus, they just limit their potential. And this reinforces the belief and it creates this vicious cycle that we need to break. Another obstacle from outside of NLP is a confirmation bias. That is that our mind is always looking for evidence that we are right about our beliefs. And that's why ingrained beliefs are so difficult to challenge. In fact, offering a clear argument to counter the belief seldom works. What we do know is that as humans, we tend to weigh the new evidence against what we already know. An exaggerated, silly example might be fairies in the garden. An adult has ample evidence that fairies don't exist, and so would easily dismiss this idea. However, a four-year-old has very limited evidence about their own lives, so they, apart from being very immature, are much more likely to believe that I saw some fairies. So research also shows that beliefs change slowly over time. There's seldom huge turnarounds except in massive emotional circumstances. So this means that if we want to change a person's beliefs, we have to work with the beliefs they already have and kind of guide them into a different direction. We can't just tell them it isn't true. We've all tried that. And we've all failed. In September 2022, NASA carried out a controlled collision with an asteroid, which they called Double Asteroid Redirection Test, or DART for short. It's okay, we're still on NLP. Okay. The mission was designed to see if it was possible to possibly nudge an asteroid that might one day be threatening the planet with devastating consequences. Well, they proved that the impact, although it was relatively small, was indeed capable of changing the asteroid's orbit, which possibly could be just enough in a real-world threatening situation to avert disaster. In a way, this is how we work with beliefs. We use the momentum of the existing belief and nudge the belief in a positive direction. Now, all the data shows that trying to block or destroy the momentum would be ineffective as far as beliefs are concerned. Our mission then is to introduce slightly different beliefs that don't completely clash with the client's existing beliefs or our own if we're working on our own beliefs, depending on who the client actually is. First, we see kind of the current evidence. You know, Michael Dawson is not good at teaching or podcasting. Now, in order to change this, I'd need to have confidence in any new evidence that is presented to me in order for it to have an effect. I can give you a personal example. I wrote some fictional novels. I thought they were okay. You know, a couple of people I love in my family said they were pretty bloody good. However, this wasn't too effective where my beliefs as a writer were concerned. And then I got reviews from people. People I don't know from the other side of the world. Someone saying, this kept me up till 6 o'clock in the morning and I had work the next day. You know, these books are a pair of novels. And this was incredibly powerful because the new evidence held so much more weight than, you know, the people I expected to say that were good. It was the trust I had in the new data that made that slight dip. So on a side note, our minds also carry a bias and we will more freely change beliefs if they offer good news or something we want. So in summary, challenging of beliefs is best done within the existing framework, and I've seen this used to great effect. So let me tell you a story I heard about a man in therapy. I'm paraphrasing the story. I probably changed some of the details, but I can't remember where I read it. But he was an ex-CIA or Special Forces guy, and he'd taken to patrolling his house at night with a gun. He was convinced that agents that he used to work with wanted him dead. Now, this was causing a lot of stress to his entire family. He wasn't told not to worry or not to do it. Instead, he was asked some questions. They said to him, when you worked for the CIA or services or whoever it was he worked for, and someone was targeted to be killed, how long would they live? And he proudly said, 3 weeks top. So the therapist then said, how long have you had this belief and have been walking around the house with a gun at night, believing that these people you used to work with were going to kill you? And he said, around 6 months. This then followed his belief system whilst also challenging it and asking him to justify his own belief. Didn't just tell him it was wrong. He was allowed to think that whole thing through. So by adapting these NLP techniques into your conversations as a residential youth worker, you can provide valuable support to young people in overcoming their limiting beliefs and help them unlock more potential. So those are some of the textbook NLP methods, but let's examine them in the context of your role in residential youth work. We probably already know how important relationship and trust are. These constantly come up as a theme. You know, authenticity is the key. When teenagers sense that your intentions are sincere and your actions align with your words, they are more likely to engage with you on a deeper level. So, you know, go back a few lessons if you missed, you know, my relationship hack in the body language section. Download the Big Four PDF from my website if you really want the extent of the importance of relationship in the work that you do. As always, I'm aware that I've been, you know, kind of willing to drift off the NLP reservation, so to speak, but I don't make any excuses for that. We're here to talk about NLP in residential youth work, not the other way around. I'm not dedicated to any one change therapy model. Job roles and clients are different, and these techniques don't always copy and paste. Calling back to my main training course, you hopefully remember the three A's. Adopt, adapt, and abandon. And only you can decide what works for you and your team. I hope we've now built a picture of how we all create our own limiting beliefs and how difficult they are to change, some ways that we can nudge them in a slightly different trajectory. So before I summarise where we are, I just want to mention three zones and how we can place ourselves, our young people, into them. Just very quickly, you know, you've got zone one is the comfort zone. We know how this works. Everything is to expectations. It's inertia. Zone two is the growth zone. It's here where we feel challenged and energized and pushed just far enough. This is where the growth happens. And zone three, of course, is the panic zone, a place where we feel no control and all we want to avoid is this. All these zones are different for different people, and if you haven't seen young people come out of a growth zone, then you haven't been in this job for very long. It's a wonderful experience to watch and to be part of, and I can attest for that as a care kid who was challenged to climb mountains and swing off a cliff on a rope. I did it, and I grew from it, because the workers were people like you. They cheered me on from start to finish. What can we take from all of this as far as our work with young people goes? Let's talk about how we can adapt these ideas into our work and look at what we've surmised. We don't choose our beliefs as we think we do. We cannot decide what we believe, and neither can our young people. It's the environment, the experiences, and the self-confirming bias that builds these beliefs. Number two, beliefs are pretty stubborn. We know they're difficult to shift, again, because of confirmation bias, because we are always looking for evidence that the belief is true. Number three, we now know that changing deeply held beliefs is a very slow process. Number four, directly confronting beliefs is seldom successful. Instead, we should nudge the belief in the right direction, just like that meteorite that was possibly going to threaten Earth one day. Number five, we learn that any new evidence is weighed against existing evidence, or how deeply held those beliefs are, or that particular relationship. Number six, new evidence is better accepted from a trusted source. This should be you and will always be weighed against what they already know. So what do we do? After all, we struggle with our own negative beliefs, so influencing others sounds like a virtual impossibility. NLP has got some tools for changing our own beliefs. To change them in others? Can we do this? Can we adapt some of these tools? Well, yes. Number one, visualization. We're unlikely to be sitting young people in a circle, cross-legged, you know. But we all visualize our futures, you know. We all visualize our future so we can encourage this building of the client's picture by utilizing the senses and encouraging the conversation through the use of ears. Elicit, amplify, repeat, start again, be the biggest fan, and combine this with the NLP law. Everyone has the resources to change. Number two, use positive and negative reframe. This is to either steal words and language from the young person to increase understanding, or to swap out their negative terms for something more positive. We also learn that finding a way to get your client to explain their belief can really loosen the bolts as they are forced to challenge their own logic. We know now that a client will give more weight to what they consider a trusted source. Now, NASA can say all day long that the Earth is round, but they are not a trusted source if you are a flat Earth community. So to become a trusted source, and we come right back to what I said time and time again about relationship. And I'm seeing that pattern consistently through all the work that we do. And for that reason, if you haven't downloaded the Big Four and Why They Matter from the website, I'd suggest you do, because the research highlights this point and it's going to come up again and again and again. Go to the website, click on Start Here, get that PDF. Because in the concepts we're talking about, limiting beliefs, once our relationship is established, we become a trusted source and we're able to offer reframed alternatives. And these are like nudges in the right direction. They're like the meteorite. So given all of this, wouldn't working as a consistent team who offer the same message while maintaining their own individual styles multiply the power of these techniques? Now, this is something I'm really passionate about. I spent several years developing a team training course for you. It's only a slight digression to suggest that if you agree with me, you may be interested in getting a look at the free version. Visit the website, theactionfactory.com, and get the free version. The full version is going to be out in late 2023, so it depends when you're listening to this. In the meantime, I've created a cheat sheet for this episode, and it will be available around here somewhere. No emails for that, or sign-ins or any of that. It'll drop right onto your device. And one more slight digression before we go. If this course is offering any value, then clicking, sharing, or subscribing is the internet's way of letting you kind of whisper to your colleagues around the world. This might help them and their clients too. If you don't, then have no fear, because I'm still going to be here in this little room talking to myself, because it's all selfishly helps me to kind of formulate my way of thinking. So thank you so much for being here. My name has been Michael Dawson. This is the Action Factory podcast. We are midway through our journey into neuro-linguistic programming in residential youth work. And I'm going to be back next Monday with another episode. So click around here, get your download, and I will see you next week.